didn't work right. If so, the repair option is to replace the canister with a spare. NASA's Keith Johnson says too much CO2 can create a condition called hypercapnia, which spacewalkers are taught to handle.
In part of our training, we allow the crew members to experience that elevated CO2 to know just exactly that it is a condition that they're experiencing and how to react to it.
NASA says Cassidy was in no danger. Friday, the spacewalkers will continue moving new batteries to a set of the space station's solar power panels. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
People are paying their final respects today to former CBS newsman Walter Cronkite, who died last Friday in Manhattan at the age of 92. Services are being held today at St. Bartholomew's Church in Midtown Manhattan. Announced speakers include Cronkite's son Chip and 60 Minutes commentator Andy Rooney. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly. Helen Todd is general director of Sugar Creek Symphony and Song in Watsika, who will present an operatic double bill in August with Leoncavallo's Pagliacci and Copland's The Tender Land. Helen will be my guest on Thursday's Life and Local. We'll also hear about a summer program for young string players in Charleston. It's Live and Local, your connection to local music, weekdays from noon to 1 on FM 90.9.
Support for WILL comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. This Saturday's wine tasting features wines from the Pacific Northwest, New Zealand, South Africa, and France, among others. More information is available at thecorkscrew.com.
Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. It is thought that something between 100,000 and 300,000 Ugandans were killed during the brutal regime of Idi Amin. When Amin was finally driven from power, Uganda declared an amnesty for his former associates. And for a lot of people in Uganda, that worked pretty well. At least it seemed that a lot of people felt that the way to deal with this time was to say, the past is past, and let's leave it buried. One man, though, we'll hear about this morning, was not satisfied with that. His name is Duncan Lockie, and his father was one of these hundreds of thousands that were killed during the Amin time. Duncan Lockie was only 9 years old when his father disappeared, and it was something that he had never been able to forget. When he grew up, he finally managed to track down the men who were responsible for the murder of his father, and they were put on trial. And this was something that in Uganda was very controversial because, as it turns out, there were a lot of people who felt that indeed it was not the thing to do, to go back and to dig up literally and figuratively this past. This is a story that Andrew Rice, a journalist, came across when he was spending time living in Uganda, and he has written about it in a recently published book. The title of his book is The Teeth May Smile, But the Heart Does Not Forget, Murder and Memory in Uganda. Metropolitan Books is the publisher. Our guest, Andrew Rice, has written about Africa for number of publications, including the New York Times Magazine, The New Republic, Portfolio, The Economist, and other publications. He spent several years in Uganda as a fellow of the Institute of Current World Affairs. He's now making his home in Brooklyn, in the United States, and he's joining us by phone to talk about the book. And, of course, questions are welcome. Questions, comments are welcome. We just ask people to be brief so we can keep moving along and hope people will stay focused on the topic in their comments, but certainly, people can join the conversation very easily by calling us here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, you certainly can join in. Mr. Rice, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And you?
I'm very well.
Good. Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. The title of the book apparently is a Ugandan proverb, and it seems pretty clear what the sentiment of the proverb is.
Yes. Well, I hope so. Although I occasionally do get questions asking exactly what its application is to this particular story.
Well, it is, and I guess as I understand it, I would think that it would be pretty clear that it says something about how it is it's possible for people to be on the outside to look like they're okay, but to be hurting on the inside.
Yes, and I think that this book is very much about one individual story, and I think it speaks to the sort of the interior conflict that a lot of people feel that is maybe not superficially expressed.
And do you think that in some way that can say something about a person, but that can also that kind of idea that on the surface everything would seem to be okay, but there are these buried hurts that can apply to a country as well?
Oh yes, of course. I mean, I think that anyone who visits Uganda, as maybe some of your listeners have, I mean, is struck by the degree to which the country has really recovered from the terrible period of dictatorship and civil war that lasted for about 20 years, from early 1970s until 1986, when the current president Yoweri Museveni took power. The country is now quite, it's still very poor, but relative to where it was before, it's booming. You know, the capital, there's skyscrapers that are going up in the capital. You can go and watch, you can go and see the premiere of Harry Potter at the Cineplex, on the same day that it comes out in New York, and in a way you feel like you're in a place that is very much healed and integrated into the world community. But beneath the surface, there's a lot of unfinished business and a lot of unfinished, a lot of traumas that remain.
And certainly, I think the book invites you to think about the way that various countries have dealt with chapters in their pasts like this. And you can think about, for example, just to name two places, Rwanda and South Africa. And there have been others where there had been truth commissions. There have been attempts to make sure that these kinds of crimes were documented, that people were accountable at the very least. People were required in a public way to acknowledge their guilt. Here in this particular case, and for reasons I'm sure that you can explain, the decision was made essentially to close the book and say, that's done, we're moving on.
Yes. I mean, the Rwanda case and the South Africa case are interesting. I mean, I did a reading the other night in New York where a woman raised her hand. She was from Argentina and, said, well, why is it that, for instance, I've been to Buenos Aires recently, and you go and you see in the main square there that people gather there once a week, I think it is, with pictures of their loved ones who disappeared under the military junta. Like, nothing like that happens in Uganda, and she was wondering why. And it was a little difficult for me to say. Some people talk about cultural differences, and I'm a little bit skeptical of that. I think it has a lot more to do with the politics of the situation. When Yoweri Museveni, the current president of Uganda, took over in 1986, he faced a number of rebellions, and one of them was a rebellion sponsored by many of the former generals underneath Idi Amin. They were still fighting and causing problems for the country. There was a brief attempt to do their version of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in about 1986-87. But shortly after it started, the government started going into peace negotiations with these rebels who were sort of the remnants of Idi Amin's army. And, the tacit bargain that was struck was, if you stop fighting the government and come in and participate even in the government or participate in rebuilding the country, we're not going to ask too many questions about the past. Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, that's why the process of forgetting was kind of encouraged, because, basically the government may, and I talked with the president about this, basically a decision was made that it was more important to have peace, to stop the killing that was plaguing the country, than it was to seek justice against the people who had perpetrated these horrible crimes.
And so in this particular case in Uganda, there hasn't really been the kind of public commemoration of these events that there have been other places, that there's no monument to the disappeared under Idi Amin.
No, there is not. And furthermore, I mean, there's not really a lot of commemoration in a it's not just physical monuments. It's that, you know, there's no holiday to commemorate the people who disappeared. There's not a lot of it's not really covered very intensely in school, or if it is covered, it's covered in this way in which almost sort of equal time is given to the people who say that Amin wasn't such a bad guy after all, of which there are a surprisingly large number of people who argue that in Uganda. So what you have is a situation in which it's sort of encouraged for people to, you know, not really come to grips with the terrible things that happened to them or to their families. You know, in some cases, their parents, aunts or uncles. You know, many of the people that I know, I'm in my early 30s. Many of the people that I know who are my age don't really know what happened to their parents. You know, oftentimes their parents had very terrible experiences that they've never shared.
Yeah. Well, you know, given Idi Amin's status as being one of the more notorious brutal dictators of the latter half of the 20th century, it seems surprising that in Uganda that there would be people who would think fondly of him.
And this is really one of the most remarkable differences that I noted while I was there. I mean, I remember even, you know, the very first day that I came to Uganda, when I was riding in, you know, in a taxi cab. I never visited the country before. There was a radio talk show debate similar to this, you know, where people were talking and calling in. And the subject was whether Amin, who is still alive at this point and living in exile in Saudi Arabia, whether Amin should be allowed to return from exile and sort of retire in Uganda. Not whether he should be tried or anything like that, but whether he should actually sort of be allowed to just kind of come home. And many people, I mean, you know, that very first exposure to the country was that, you know, many people were calling in and saying, yeah, let him come home. You know, he's been away long enough. He wasn't so bad. A lot of it's tied up in a very somewhat complicated history of colonial and post-colonial economic exploitation that, you know, a lot of people felt that Amin, for whatever, as brutal as he was sort of standing up for Africans against the British and against particularly a merchant class within Uganda that was from India, which he expelled. And people thought, well, you know, he's returning the economy to Africans. And so people still associate him with this sort of nationalist Ugandan pride.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is journalist Andrew Rice. And the story that we are exploring here is told in his recent book, The Teeth May Smile, But the Heart Does Not Forget, Murder and Memory in Uganda. And it's published by Metropolitan Books. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, I don't want to spend too much time, and I'm sure that we could talk in depth about Ugandan history from independence forward, but maybe you could talk just a little bit about first the government as it existed, say, from 1962 up until 1971 when Idi Amin took over. The head of government during that time, from the end of the British rule, amounted to a British colony, and from that point up until the coup when Amin took power, the head of government was a man named Milton Obote. What was Uganda like when he was leading the country?
Well, the story of Uganda from independence in 1962 until 1971 is very much the story of Africa. What happened in Uganda happened all over the continent in so many different countries at the same time. And basically what the story was is that, you know, the British kind of left quite abruptly. You know, they they made a declaration that they were going to leave their African colonies behind. And within a few years, they were gone. And they made a very perfunctory attempt to cultivate a few leaders after spending many years of kind of imprisoning these people as nationalists who are trying to overthrow colonial rule. They then sort of let them out of prison and said, okay, well, we're going, you know, now you're going to be our guys. And one of them in Uganda, the man that they sort of burnished for this role was a man named Milton Obote, who was a sort of professorial political figure. He became president in 1962 and gradually became more and more autocratic and dictatorial. In the beginning, it was very much a hopeful kind of era. There was a lot of British money actually came in to kind of build some institutions and so on. But Obote didn't, like a lot of these leaders, basically the model that he had was a sort of autocratic one from the colonial era, and he didn't brook any more dissent than the British had. And by the time he was overthrown in 1971, he was highly unpopular, and Amin's coup was actually welcomed with celebrations in the streets.
So some people, at least at that time when Amin took over, thought, well, this is going to be good for the country.
Oh, well, not just some people within Uganda. I mean, you know, the British, if you go back and read, you know, British newspapers, American newspapers at the time, a lot of people welcomed it, saying that, you know, well, this, especially because it happened against a Cold War backdrop, and Obote had been sort of cozying up to the communist bloc. A lot of people said, well, you know, Amin seems to be, he's not a communist. He's a populist. He's a man of the people. You know, he's a man we can deal with. And within Uganda, a lot of people said he's a man we can manipulate. He's a man that who can be useful to advance our political agenda. And of course, all of those estimations proved to be disastrously wrong.
So, during the time that Amin was in power, as I said, he certainly had the reputation as being one of the world's worst abusers of human rights. And no one, I guess, knows precisely how many people died, but it's a pretty stunning number to think that it could be hundreds of thousands of people. What was at the root of that? What was that about?
Well, it started off, I mean, I think that you can see everywhere in the world a similar trend in dictatorships, which is that, you know, the dictators start off by eliminating real threats, and then they move on to pursue to eliminating perceived threats, and then they eventually just, you know, start eliminating people at random or in an almost sort of I guess whimsical way. Whimsical is the wrong word. You know, for reasons of their whims. You know, you know, basically the way it started off was that the first people who were eliminated were people who were associated with Milton Obote in one way or another. So members of his tribe, people who were loyal to him within the army, people who were politically loyal to him. And then it subsequently moved on to intellectuals. It moved on, you know, to a great number of other people, broadened out until by the end, Amin was really killing everybody, including, you know, he eliminated a lot of people who were very close to him, who had been instrumental in helping to bring him to power.
The man that we're talking about here at the heart of the story, I'm thinking actually, well, it's Duncan Lockey is at the heart of the story. But to take a step back from there, really the heart of the story is his father and his and Duncan's interest in trying to investigate the disappearance and death of his father and find out what happened. So who was Eliphas Lockey?
Well, Eliphas Lockey was sort of in the... when I sort of talk about those concentric circles of people who are eliminated, he was probably in the, you know, he was among the first people who were targeted. And the reason why is because he had been a chief, which was sort of like a civil servant under Milton Obote's rule. and a very strong supporter of the ruling party, and was a sort of, you know, kind of a figure of local prominence in this one area of western Uganda called Ankole. And he, after Amin's coup, he did something that you know, did not come to light for many years, but he smuggled a young militant who was also from the same area, somebody who had been working for the president and was kind of like a bit of a Marxist rabble-rouser. He smuggled this young man to safety in Tanzania. And that young man's name was Yoweri Museveni. He's now the president of Uganda. The reason that this became significant is that later Yoweri Museveni started a rebellion against Idi Amin, and actually launched an invasion of Uganda. I mean, calling it an invasion is a little bit much. It was a very ragtag sort of attempt to start a guerrilla war against Uganda that was quickly snuffed out. And some people knew about Al-Fazlachi's association with this man, Yoweri Museveni. And so after that invasion happened, he was very quickly marked for elimination. Some men came to his office and took him away in his own car, in this Volkswagen Beetle that he owned, which was, you know, this Volkswagen Beetle was very much like a symbol of how, you know, influential and powerful he was, because, you know, hardly anybody had cars in those days in Uganda. And they took him away in his car, and he was never seen again. At that time, his son Duncan was 9 years old. And he was there that day, you know, was among the last people to see him before he was taken away. But very little was ever known about what happened to him for many years. You know, it was assumed that he had disappeared. It was assumed that he was dead. But nobody really ever knew what happened to him, as was the case with the many, many, many thousands of Amin's victims.
Yeah. We're at our midpoint here. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and the guest is Andrew Rice. He's a journalist who's written about Africa for The New York Times Magazine, The New Republic, Portfolio, The Economist, among other publications. He spent several years in Uganda as a fellow of the Institute of Current World Affairs, now makes his home in the United States, in Brooklyn, and he is the author of this recently published book that tells the story of murder and memory in Uganda. That's the subtitle. The title of the book is The Teeth May Smile, But the Heart Does Not Forget. It's published by Metropolitan Books. And again, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. For Duncan, the son of the man that you were just talking about, his disappearance and the near certainty that he was dead. This was something that Duncan just couldn't forget, couldn't let go of, even though a lot of people, including I think his own mother, told him that he should.
Yes, I mean, you know, after Amin was overthrown in 1979, during the 7 years between his father's disappearance and Amin's overthrow, for obvious reasons, the issue couldn't be pursued, you know, because there's a dictator in power and pursuing it would make you a target. But even after he was overthrown in 1979, his mother, other people in his family, advised him just to let the matter go, because there was a real fear that not just of Amin wasn't the sole problem. The real problem had to do with, you know, a fear that, you know, he had been informed on by people who were in the area. They didn't know who those people might be. There was a general feeling that, you know, if you dug these things up and started talking about them, only bad things could come of it. You know, very little benefit could come of it. The only thing you'd find out was a little truth, you know, to comfort yourself. But in so doing, you might endanger your family. You might also sort of cause to you know to be, pain to your family by reviving some of these traumas. Mm. And so Duncan was really, for most of his life, was really prevented from or discouraged from pursuing any of these very natural questions about wanting to know what had happened to his father. And on a very fundamental level, he really wanted to get his father's body back, because he felt that, especially in the African tradition, but I think in every tradition, you know, the remains of a family member are a very valuable thing that the people need for purposes of, you know, not just of closure for themselves, but, you know, really for sort of like, you know, in the African tradition, it's, you know, it's taught that if you're not buried on your own land, that you become sort of an unquiet soul, or a ghost, you know, that's just roaming, you know. And while Duncan didn't necessarily believe in like the old superstitions like that, you know, that idea that his father was not at rest was something that really plagued him.
Yeah, and you came to know him, and I'm sure you spent a lot of time talking with him. There were, I'm sure, many, many other people who'd lost family members in this time who wouldn't have done what Duncan did. If you ask him, well, in the face of this kind of resistance, you got resistance from your family, you know that there could, in fact, be some danger maybe to you or to your family if you pursued this. You asked him, well, why did you do it? What did he say?
Well, he felt very strongly that it was necessary for him to know what had happened to his father, and that he wouldn't really be doing justice to the memory of his father if he didn't find out what had happened to him, and he, especially this issue of his body. You know, it bothered him very much, the idea that, you know, that wherever his father was, that he was, you know, in some way unconsecrated or, you know, unremembered. And the idea that he was just supposed, and this was from his own brothers and sisters, you know, the idea that they were just supposed to forget the fact that he had lived and really just kind of move on, you know, that gnawed at Duncan, and it was very difficult for him to deal with. But you're right, there are many other people within Uganda, in Duncan's own family, other families who have taken a different course. Actually, the way that Duncan reacted to this was very unusual in the Ugandan context.
Yeah. The key to this all was the car. This is a great part of the story. And as you mentioned, Eliphaz was taken away in his own car. And because the car was valuable, the guys who took him and it wouldn't just throw it away. They wouldn't just junk it. So apparently Duncan thought about that car for a long time, and he managed to find it again. It actually had the same license plate as when his father had had it, and so he managed to find the person who had the car.
Right. Well, it was like a step more bureaucratic than that. Actually, he found a registration file for it. So he found this forged document where the guy who, you know, basically a forged signature of his father's transferring ownership of this car to an unfamiliar person. This is sort of like one of those weird irrational things about dictatorships, which is that they were perfectly willing to kill people, but they wanted to like have the proper documentation for registering the car, you know. So basically that, you know, he re-registered this fellow, this individual named Mohamed Anyule, had re-registered this car in his own name after Duncan's father's death, and yes, he kept the same license plate number, and driven the car for some time. Duncan actually hired some private investigators who were able to go and track this man down. He was still alive. He was living in an area of northwestern Uganda known as West Nile, which was the sort of tribal region that Idi Amin was from. And they found this guy, and they arrested him and interrogated him, and he said, you know, after some interrogation, he said, well, you know, I was just the driver on the mission. The guy who shot him was his fellow Nasser Gile, and they went. And Nasser Gile was happened to also still be alive. They found him. He was working as a bicycle repairman. They arrested him, and he said, you know, well, yeah, I shot this guy. I remember this, but I did it on orders from an officer, and this man's name was Yusuf Gwan.
And this man, this was Idi Amin's chief of staff, so this was a big guy.
Right. Well, as soon as this guy's name, Yusuf Gwan, was mentioned, the case became a lot more complicated because, you're right, exactly. He had subsequently, after the incidents that took place in this trial, he had been promoted a few times and eventually become the second in command to Idi Amin. And he had gone into exile in 1979, but he had come back under this amnesty agreement that I referred to earlier in the early 1990s. And not only had he come back, but his return had been sort of had been accompanied by much public fanfare. The government had sort of trumpeted the fact that Yusuf Gwan was back in Uganda as an advertisement for how Uganda had reconciled with its past and was no longer was no longer sort of at war with itself. And so when Yusuf Gwan's name was mentioned, all of a sudden the case took on very serious political overtones, because there's a real question about, you know, would it be possible to prosecute somebody who, in a way, was a symbol of the government's policies?
Well, I'm sure that for the authorities, this was difficult, because here they had these two guys who confessed to being involved. The one man said, yes, I was the driver. The other man said, yes, I was the shooter. And then said, but this highly placed government official had given these orders. So here the authorities have these confessions. They have somebody who had been really important. They have to consider the terms of the amnesty. Were they, in fact, annoyed that they had to deal with all of this when the policy had been to say that the past is past and we're not going to go back?
Well, yes. I mean, this was the annoyance was on a couple of different levels. One is that Duncan had hired private investigators who really generated a lot of this evidence. So the when he went to the police with it, which it became necessary to, obviously, if they were going to be arrested, if they're going to be put on trial, there was a little bit of a feeling like, you know, that Duncan, who is a, you know, fairly, within a Ugandan context, fairly wealthy guy, you know, he's a lawyer and so on, that this guy was kind of like, you know, engaging in sort of freelance police work. I think that there was a little bit of, the police were a little bit taken aback by that, and that he sort of dumped this case in their lap. But they did go ahead and pursue it. And part of the reason that they pursued it, I think, is that they, you know, there was not a, when I said that, the, you know, that there was this amnesty policy, a lot of what had happened was sort of done with a wink and a nudge, and you know, like the president would say something that made it sound like all is forgiven, but, you know, not a lot of it was really written on paper. I mean, that's not the way these things always work in Africa, and so there was some real ambiguity about what exactly Gwan could be prosecuted for. But the police looked into it, the lawyers looked into it, and said, well, you know, actually these guys, the amnesty really only covers things after this current government, the Museveni government, had taken power in 1986. So anything before this, they're actually still technically legally liable for. So it was able to go forward on that basis. But there was doubt and real kind of division within Uganda about the legitimacy of the prosecution that followed the case all the way through its course.
One of the things that you talk about, and it is interesting, is that while the news media in Uganda did cover the case, it maybe didn't get the level of coverage you might expect, given particularly the prominence of General Gowan, who's maybe the most important of the three. And this, you got onto the story because you were in Uganda at the time and you were reading about it in the newspapers. What was it that made you want to pursue this further and to actually talk with Duncan Lockey?
Well, I saw the story. You know, I had moved to Uganda with this grant from this foundation that you mentioned, the Institute of Current World Affairs, which is like kind of it's a really great grant for young journalists. They just kind of send you to foreign countries and say, you know, write about anything you want. You know, that's great, but I was also kind of looking for some stories to tell that would illustrate what was going on in Uganda, and I saw one day this story in the newspaper that about this case that Yusuf Gowon was on trial, but it was a very small article in the newspaper, and not a lot of background was mentioned. And then eventually, I managed to meet Duncan and heard his story, and I thought, you know, that this really illustrated in a way a lot of interesting things that weren't really being publicly talked about in a way that were possible for me to write about as a journalist. You know, it brought out a lot of things, you know, as we said at the very beginning, you know, a lot of the superficial healing that had gone on in Uganda, you know, this really kind of ran counter to a lot of what seemed to be happening on the surface, and that's what really made it interesting for me as a journalist.
Yeah. You said that the reaction to the case in the country was divided. I'm sure that there were people, so many people would have lost family members. Maybe some of those people would have thought, you know, I think I would like to do this. I need to know where my father is, where my son is. There needs to be someone held accountable. And at the same time, I'm sure there were a lot of other people who said, no, we've said we're not going to do that. We just have to go on. Can you talk a little bit more about that, how that reaction was played out publicly?
Well, it was played out publicly in a very interesting way. I mean, I think, you know, I met a few people, you know, at the trial. People would come to the trial and say, you know, I attended it every day for, you know, it didn't happen on every single day, but it went on for about a year and a half. So I followed it for that entire period of time, and I would meet people who frequently who said, "Oh, well, you know, I've lost a family member in the same way. This is why I'm interested in the trial." You'd meet other people in there, actually, probably more people at the trial were there because they had actually been in the army with Yusuf Gowon. Or they were members of his tribe from this area called West Nile, and they were there at the trial because they felt just as strongly as these family members, the people who disappeared, felt that this was a wonderful sort of a strike against impunity or whatever. The people from West Nile felt just as strongly that this thing was a show trial that was really meant to sort of humiliate their own people and to increase, you know, they already sort of felt themselves to be like the losers of history. And so, you know, so they really felt like this trial was an injustice.
I'm sure that there were people who felt that by reopening this, there was the potential for touching off real conflict between various interests, between people who had various loyalties, between people who had a role in the regime and people who had lost family members. That could open this whole thing up again, not only just to debate, but to violence. Did anything like that happen?
Well, nothing like that happened, but it was very explicitly talked about by Yusuf Gowon's defense attorney, who was this very young guy in his 20s who was sort of like had created this role for himself, you know, as sort of the Johnny Cochran of Uganda, and he, you know, he very definitely, you know, brought out the fact that he felt that, you know, one element of his defense was going to be, you know, political, that he was going to try to, you know, try to bring up the fact that, or even stir up some of these tensions, especially in this area called West Nile, which is where Amin's people were from and where some of the rebellions had been. And when I traveled up there during the trial, there were, you know, people were very, very, very angry, and I don't think angry enough to actually take up arms, but the government couldn't be sure that wouldn't be the case. I mean, there were, at the time they were, you know, they faced there was some real talk that people who had served Amin were maybe going to go back into Congo or into Sudan, which are neighboring regions, because they no longer felt safe if Gawan was going to be arrested. They felt like the government had betrayed its promises and so on. And the government had to take all of this very seriously because, you know, that area is still quite unstable and really someplace that has, some places that where there's a real danger of future unrest.
About 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus. Our guest is Andrew Rice. He's written about Africa for the New York Times Magazine, The New Republic, The Economist. He spent several years in Uganda as a fellow of the Institute of Current World Affairs, and he is the author of the recently published book, The Teeth May Smile, But the Heart Does Not Forget, Murder and Memory in Uganda. Metropolitan Books is the publisher. Questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. There was a trial, but ultimately the charges against these men were dropped. They had at one point confessed to being involved, and then they recanted. So they said that their confessions were coerced. They were thrown out. The case was dropped. Is there any indication you think that at some high level of government there was pressure put on the prosecutors to essentially to make this go away?
I don't think the pressure was on the prosecutors, but there was one very interesting wrinkle of the case was that the judge who was the person sitting in judgment of the case and actually sort of deciding the admissibility of the evidence was a Muslim, which in the Ugandan context, he was actually the only Muslim judge in the entire high court. And if you know anything about Idi Amin was also a Muslim. He was very much associated with the Muslim people in Uganda, and a lot of his defenders were Muslims. So some people wondered why it was that this particular judge had been assigned the case, and wondered also why he made some of the decisions that he did, which were very adverse to the prosecution. At almost every turn, the judge was very adverse to the prosecution within the Ugandan context. And, you know, I looked into the legal reasoning of his judgments, and I have to say that, you know, there clearly were flaws with the prosecution, flaws with the way the police investigated the case and the way the police handled evidence and so on. However, within the Ugandan context, you know, one interesting thing about this trial is that it reveals the way in which, you know, everybody is sort of seen as a member of a group, and the group that he was seen as a member of was the Muslim group, and you know, hence he was assumed to have been a sympathizer of Amin's, even though when I talked to him he very much said that he did not care for Amin himself at all.
So as far as Duncan Lockey was concerned, he saw these men identified, saw them confess, saw them put on trial. They weren't convicted, but he did accomplish something else that he wanted. They took him to the place where they had killed his father, and he found his father's remains.
Yes. Well, prior to the trial, when Mohamed Anyule and Nasser Gile eventually stopped cooperating with the prosecution, but during the time period when they were cooperating, they actually led him to this pasture, this field where they said they had killed his father. And after a long period of searching, he eventually did find the shallow grave in which his father had been buried. The body was actually sent to the United States for DNA testing, and then brought back, and there was a funeral in 2002, which I attended, in which he finally was laid to rest on his own land, you know, according to the way tradition says he should be, and given, you know, what, you know, this stone that they had erected in their, you know, that by their farm, saying, you know, Lord grant us decent rest and disappearance no more. He was finally given that decent rest.
You know, one of the things that I did in preparing for the conversation was I listened to an interview that you did on Public Station in New York about the book, and Duncan Lockey was there with you. The two of you were there sitting together talking with the interviewer, and the interviewer said something to Duncan Lockey about closure, asking him if he felt that he had had some measure of closure, and Duncan's comment was something like, well, I'm not exactly sure what that means. After all of this was said and done, he managed to find his father's remains. Certainly the men were identified but not convicted. How did he feel about it all, and whether he was, whether he had achieved some measure of peace maybe about it all?
I think Duncan is a very philosophical person, you know, and an extraordinarily strong person. I mean, the reason he was able to do the interview with me and is that he now lives in New York, in New Jersey. He's a fairly high-ranking official at the Ugandan mission to the United Nations. So he's had a great deal of success in his life. He has a couple of kids. They go to suburban public schools. His wife is a doctor here in the U.S. And you know, he lives a very kind of American life. But part of him is always back in Uganda, and part of him is never going to heal because of what happened to him. I mean, he grew up without a father, and I don't think that in the end, I think one lesson that's learned from all of these experiences, and I've talked to many people who have had all sorts of different outcomes in terms of investigating these sorts of things that have been done to them or done to their family, whether for this story or for other, you know, articles that I've written having to do with other countries. And you know, the one thing that I notice, the one thing that I note is, I think that it's never an external set of circumstances that makes someone come to terms with something. It's always something that comes from within, and I think that Duncan healed himself, you know, but at the same time, I think what his comments on that show reflected were, you know, that no resolution to this case is ever going to give him what he really wanted, which is to have a father. Mm.
Were there, as a result of this case and his experiences, were there other people in Uganda that tried to do what he did?
Yes, there have been a number of other cases like this. And even since the book has come out, I've received emails from people, you know, in Uganda who want to contact Duncan in order to try to do something similar to what he did. So there has been a real kind of, you know, there have been real efforts. He proved to be really an inspiration to a lot of people. There's also been, since this happened, I think, you know, there's been quite a bit of a movement toward remembering things a bit more, and there have been a lot of memoirs published, and you know, a great deal of conversation surrounded the appearance of the film The Last King of Scotland a couple of years ago, and the country has started to, in a way, like I say at the end of the book, you know, all of these things, you know, in a way make one think that perhaps the events that happened in this book did not happen in a vacuum, and that there's a larger process of remembrance or recovery of memory that's going on.
Yeah. Maybe we should mention, or I should mention, that in fact that the trial we're talking about here, this took place in 2002.
So well, 2003.
It was some music, and at the time when the trial started, Idi Amin was actually still alive. He was living in exile in Saudi Arabia, but he was still alive.
He actually died right in the middle of the trial, which sparked sort of an interesting kind of counterpoint to the trial for the purposes of my book, in that, you know, during the time that he died and was in his coma, well, he was in a coma for a period of time and then he died, there was this great debate in Uganda about his legacy and whether he should be buried in Uganda. And some people even argued that he should be buried with state honors in Uganda. And, you know, and it was a really remarkable kind of exhibit of exactly how divided the country remains about his legacy.
Yeah. Well, I read this really interesting story about something that happened during the making of the film, The Last King of Scotland. They apparently made some of the movie in Uganda, and the actor, Forrest Whitaker, who played Amin, and who I think, if I remember right, actually won an Academy Award for his performance, it was as if Amin had come back, and some people were chanting his name, and then there were some people who, you know, no doubt would have wanted to do him violence. So at that point, it was still so real, and that, you know, it might say something about Forrest Whitaker too as an actor, but it was so real that people were responding. Here it was this man, he was an actor, they were making a movie, but it was almost as if the ghost of Idi Amin had come back.
Well, people, you know, Idi Amin is never, in a way, he's never really far from the public consciousness in Uganda. You know, if they wanted to forget him, well, we keep reminding them because, you know, we keep making movies about this guy and writing books about this guy. And, you know, in some way, his brutality is, you know, cinematic or captures something that people, you know, want to say about Africa. And so Ugandans know that. And I think, you know, in an odd way, you know, he's still the most famous Ugandan who ever lived. So there's an odd sense of pride that some people even have in the fact that Idi Amin, you know, was their own. You know, that he in some way is this figure who, you know, thumbed his nose at, you know, every convention. You know, overcame. You know, he called himself the conqueror of the British Empire and so on. You know, Ugandans, you know, as brutal as he was, and again, I think part of this is because the brutality of it has been forgotten. But, you know, as brutal as he was, Ugandans, you know, haven't really had a leader who, since him, that they really felt like was trying to make his own course separate and apart from the Western powers who are always sort of trying to bullying them and telling them what to do and throwing money at them and preaching at them and so on. And,
yeah,
you know, Amin was separate and apart from that, so he still has his fans.
If you want to read more of the story that we've been talking about here this morning, the book to look for is The Teeth May Smile, But the Heart Does Not Forget, Murder and Memory in Uganda, published by Metropolitan Books, by our guest, Andrew Rice. He's written about Africa for The New York Times Magazine, The New Republic, The Economist, other publications. Mr. Rice, thanks.
If you just allow me real quickly,
yes.
They can also find out more at www.andrewrice.net. And I also have they plug the book's name into Facebook. There's also a group page.
All right. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois, providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston, Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. There are no substitutes for donated blood. Blood donation takes 45 minutes and saves lives. Information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org. This is WILL. We're a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. That's it for us on Focus. We want you to stay tuned. No more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll talk about germs. Our guest will be Mary Rubush. She is a medical scientist and the author of a book with a rather surprising title, Why Dirt is Good, 5 Ways to Make Germs Your Friends. We'll talk with Mary Rubush following the 1 o'clock news this afternoon. Let's take a look at commodity prices in Kansas City. September wheat, 566, up 11 and a quarter. December, 582 and a half, up 11. In Chicago, September wheat, 534, up 12. December, 561 and a quarter, up 12 and a quarter. September corn, 325 and three quarters, up 17 and three quarters. December, 338, up 18 and three quarters. March, 351 and a quarter, up 18 and a half. May, 360 and three quarters, up 18 and a quarter. August beans, 1026 and a quarter, up 7 and three quarters. September, 964, up 19. November, 934, up 26. January, 940 and three quarters, up 26. August meal, 323.40.